Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, dedicated to bringing some sophisticated persuasion tools to this complicated, crazy modern world. I'm Dr. Dan. I'm the host, rhetorician, comedian. I have a PhD in rhetoric, and I'm a late night comedy writer and stand up. I'm a small subset of things. On the podcast, I talk to comedians about their politics. I convert conservatives when they're on here because I think they need it. Come back to democracy. It's not that bad. I chat with people who have causes, trying to get some new things into the world. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians. More rhetoricians on this podcast than you'll hear on any other podcast today. This is another episode of Persuasion Pros. I wander into people through other people all the time. And this, my guest today is a really interesting collision of a few people that I know. She has a big history in film production, which she has wrangled over into her own company, Safety Compliance Services, which provides event safety services to entertainment and live events industry. And they're expanding into corporate, state, federal, everywhere that needs to be safe, which turns out to be everywhere. So this is a huge area in rhetoric, the rhetoric of safety. And that's what I'm titling today's show. And we're going to talk about quite a bit. So Teresa Beardsley.
So cool. Thank you so much for having me, Dan. I love it. You know, when I first started looking into your work, I'm like, what is a rhetorician? Wow. And I really sort of was like, oh my gosh, what a cool combination, and how perfect as a comedian too.
Right.
Really cool work.
Well, it's really this kind of hyper focus on messaging. You know, most people communicate naturally and they don't add in the hyper formality of big theory and long, you know, years, centuries of research and all this. So I think people, when they run into it, they're interested by it because it looks like an elevation of what they naturally do, which kind of is.
Oh my gosh. And there is such a history and a science behind it. Sorry, my cat might be going crazy in the background. He's
all right. Totally fine. Animals can do whatever they want on the podcast.
Great. Yeah, he will.
So run your background a little bit for people, because you do have kind of a double background too, of film production. And now you've moved over to starting a safety company.
Yeah. So, you know, I was a theater major and I actually started off in scenography. So painting large sets.
Really? What's that called?
Scenography.
Oh, scenography. I thought you added something else in there, like estenography. And I'm like, what?
Oh yeah, no, scenography. So, you know, making things look like, you know, things like, you know, making the big backgrounds look like, you know, houses or weird, you know, we did a lot of like weird, you know, theatrical things just above and beyond, you know, definitely different, way different than film. And they get on that big scaffolding and paint, you know, that was what I did mostly in college. And I was in the theater. I didn't join the theater until I was in college. I took some acting classes, which before that I was so shy. I never spoke to another human being before I was in theater.
Sure. I think a lot of people get into theater through that avenue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Either a massive extrovert or a massive introvert.
Oh, totally. And, you know, some people were all about it and, you know, they really wanted to be out there. I didn't. But I sort of enjoyed the art of performance. I really loved the theater. I was a creative writing major, philosophy. I wanted to be a lawyer, which is funny now. I worked in a law office and took myself into, you know, theater school. And now I do entertainment and I'm in law school.
Oh, okay. There you go. Well, you can't get away from your worlds either.
Right. Yeah. You know, and then, you know, it's like I did my thing in New York. I was mostly in production. I was working in burger joints, bartending, you know, getting into, you know, acting and And then I learned how to produce. I took some classes. I learned how to produce from this wonderful woman, Judy Gordon, commercial theater. She was one of the first people who produced Liza Minnelli in her New York debut, old school theater.
Yeah, that is.
New York. Wow. It just, and it amazed me. And so I moved to LA and started working in film, which is a real change from theater. But, you know, I like the people. I like where it takes my curiosity. You know, I think I mostly like the people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think right. That's true. Like even in comedy writing, like writing jokes is fun, but after a while it's just mechanical. Just you're just writing jokes. But if you're in a room with, you know, six, seven, eight other funny people that you like, it's just a pleasure to come into work.
Truly. And we get to explore such interesting things. It's never boring.
Yeah, that's true. That is a dictate in Hollywood. You cannot be boring. No matter what your job is, where you're in the funnel, you know, the pipeline, you still have to bring interesting to it.
Oh, totally. And I mean, you can't throw a rock and hit something remotely boring around here. It's like, it's everything's got a story. You know, it's, and also, you know, I'm from a small town, like, you know, 1200 people back in the 90s. I think it's doubled now, maybe 3000 population, 3000. Like, you know, I always wanted that. I always enjoy, you know, being in a cosmopolitan, interesting world, you know?
Sure. Yeah, me too. Coming from Kentucky, this is a wonderful contrast. Like a lot of people, I think, who have a ton of city experience growing up, still they can get over, you know, they're like, it's just a city. And I'm like, I'm still kind of in wonder a lot of the times when I'm in a big city. I'm like, look at this place.
Oh, the people that you meet, like all the things that you're exposed to. You know, I think in New York, they talk about the 7 train that takes you through probably every single culture as you roll into the city, you know, wow.
Yeah, for sure. I used to say there's no way you can move to someplace like New York or Los Angeles and stay racist because you'd just be exhausted. There's just too many people. You don't even know who to hate. You don't even know what people are. Like, you've never even heard of this country. It's like, so it's really it's a different orientation. I've always enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, you can't make assumptions.
So you were in film production and you were largely doing producing or?
Yeah, producing, coordinating, you know, assistant to, you know, executive producers, you know, all that. And I loved being behind the scenes. You know, I had my day in front of the camera. That was fine. I don't have the passion for it.
Right. Yeah. Either you better be obsessed with it or crazy talented or both.
Yeah. And it's not satisfying to me at all. It's very frustrating. You know, and I've never liked being at the will of other people.
Well, then you're made to be a producer.
Right. So I enjoyed that. And then of course, 2020 hit and we all lost our jobs, you know, everybody that I knew, we had nothing, you know, people left, the whole business changed. And, you know, and it's like, in order to do our jobs, we have to be in person. It doesn't work otherwise. Right. So that's how I started my company. Really is like, I was out of work and everybody I knew was out of work. And so I heard about this new job and it was going to be required on set. And I was like, oh, that's the one I want. That's the job.
Yeah. Something that's required. That's not going away because the government says you will do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, that's what I want to do. And, you know, and it was hard because you're also the most hated person on set. You're the compliance person. And, you know, it was a weird change and, you know, and then I was like, I told all my friends about it, got them trained up, hired, you know, and got people out in the field, got people working. And then we grew and like, we've done over 350 shows since June 2020. And then when that started to sort of, you know, I always knew there was going to be a day when that COVID compliance in entertainment was really just going to fall to the wayside. And, you know, I'd gotten involved in January of last year with this awesome nonprofit called the Event Safety Alliance. They're super cool, literally policymakers of American national standards in safety and entertainment. So incredible. It's an organization of incredible people, like, and also just the kindest, you know, the safety mm-hmm. people are really the nicest, most caring humans. And I learned so much about overall entertainment safety. And so because of that, I was like, well, that's what I want to do next. You know, let's go there. Let's do that, you know?
Yeah, like I said, when we launched, in my world, which studies sort of rhetoric storms. So if a certain form of talk comes up around an industry or around a human activity, it tends to pattern itself. And there are effective ways of talking there and middle ground and ineffective. And what rhetoricians come in and do is they study that. And they're like, here are the ways that you should talk if you want to get the results that you're after. And so like you hit at the very, you know, beginning of this, the idea of compliance, which again is massive in public safety and any type of dealing with human beings. How do you get compliance, even for things that are good for them or in theory good for them? So like you said, you're the hated person on set, which I have a friend who's an actress and she does a lot of extra work and stand-in work. And she's always complaining about the compliance people. So talk about that a little bit. Like, I mean, because that is a rhetorical position. You've got to figure out ways to get people to do this. And there are ways to do it where they're somewhat happy with it. And there are ways that they hate you. There are ways that they'll sneak around. It's very complicated.
Oh, we are the worst.
Do you use power and say you will do this? Or are you sort of a requester? You know, what are your strategies?
Yeah, so I have a very specific, we do have sort of a very specific culture that we go about it with. And I, you know, I think it started with me. I, as a natural rebel slash anarchist slash, you know, the idea of compliance makes me want to vomit too, you know, honestly, you know, it feels weird, but if you think about, like, why do you stop at stop signs and why do you look both ways when you cross the road? And it's like, we do these things for each other's safety, right? For really, it's for each other and being part of a community of greater, you know, this greater connection between all of us. And it's what helps all of us move on with our lives, right? So I think when you're in that position and you find yourself having to sort of be that, you know, I'm going to tell on you, or, you know, be that person that, you know, that kind of like ruins the party.
Right.
You know, I actually find that, you know, and it's kind of interesting because I have seen a lot of different sets and different networks have different things that they like to do. The most successful environments for safety are when when your safety people, your compliance people are just kind and welcoming and understanding that this is really frustrating for all of us. Nobody likes to wear a mask 12 hours a day, 16 hours a day. And it's like, if it's going to be one of those KN95s, which do work the best, but if it's got to be something like that, it's going to hurt your face.
Right.
It's not comfortable. And we're all pushed to our limits with all of the extra things that we have to do that we didn't used to. I think it's really important to just be kind to people, and you know, and really just check in with them and let them know that you care, because it's really easy to slip into the thing of you can't do that and you can't do that. You know, it's not the way to do it. It's not community oriented, right?
Yeah, and in my world, I call that nice suasion. Like it's all the interpersonal techniques that you sort of know as a human being and that you use when you're in a good relationship with people, like validating that you know it's hard, you know, stating information that everybody, you know, needs to do this because of these reasons, all those things that allow people to sort of stay in relationship with you, in a positive relationship with you, so that you're on the same side versus, you know, the domineering, you will do this because otherwise you'll be fired, yada, 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 you know.
Right. And you know what? I have to tell you, the best results I've seen have been with leadership who have nurtured that environment, rather than in some cases where they've gone so hard, right? Because they wanted to show everybody that they care, that they're doing all this stuff, they're super proactive. And where they do encourage that sort of militant, are actually the ones that are the worst with the results. Right. Honestly, it's interesting.
Yeah, human psychology, I talk about this because I have a course in persuasion for parents. And a lot of parents think that, you know, a lot of cultures use dominance with kids. Like, you will do this. These are the instructions. It's command and control. And if you go against that, you are a horrible human being, horrible kid. I'm going to punish you. And I'm like, well, if you set up dominance on any human being, you know, a lot of human beings may have been stomped down where they don't have a lot of overt resistance, but they have tons of inner emotional and cognitive resistance to what you're doing. And they will find a way around it. They will find ways to erode you, to cause you problems, because you've set up a contentious relationship at the very beginning.
Exactly. Yes. Ding, ding, ding. You totally. Also, that's genius. Yeah. Persuasion class.
Well, because nobody ever gets really taught persuasion skills. Like, right. You've developed your own theories and your own strategies here based on trial and error and observation, and kind of, you seem like a nice person, so you've probably been successful using niceness, you know, in your life. And so you're already trained up in a lot of those skills, and you probably know how to create, you know, a sense of community and things like that. So it plays into your skill set, you know, and your orientation. But if we came in and was like, okay, that's not working here, and we're like, we're going to shift and go aggro, sheer dominance and power, and you had to do those things, like you said, you'd be uncomfortable. You probably wouldn't be as effective. But what rhetoricians do is they just know the entire menu, and they really don't care. Like, whatever works, they will use. So nice suasion, if that works in that environment, yeah, let's amplify it and do it as absolute best as we can.
Wow. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think about what I would experience when I was on that side, when I was in production. If people were rude to me, I didn't, you know, it's, I think it's also sort of natural within us, to just be really resistant to that. I did this awesome, I mean, well, okay, it was a reality show.
You know, you don't have to apologize. It's Hollywood. I don't. Everybody, different products for different people.
But you know what? I was living in a resort on the beach in Costa Rica for several months, and it was. How could you say no to that?
Right.
And I was, you know, on the medical team, and I was, you know, doing COVID tests and you know, making sure everybody got in and seen and that everybody was on their cadence and this and that. And every morning when I would see everybody, I just made sure to say hello, check in with them. How are they doing? You know, we're working 16-hour days. Some people were working around the clock, and you know, and it's hard. And I made sure to just be really kind. And some people were going through a really difficult time. And one girl said to me at the end, she just came up and hugged me and cried. And she goes, "You're one of the reasons I made it through this show, because it was just so nice to see you in the morning." And she's like, "That's so weird to say, because in Costa Rica, when you did your COVID test, they don't do it like they do here. They don't do that mid-nasal. No, they go all the way up." And it was really uncomfortable. And like our doctor, like such a cool guy, but he would like wiggle the. It was painful. And, you know, and for somebody to say to me that that was the best part of their day was really, and they said that it made them want to participate. Like, and I said, "Cool. You know, I'm really glad that I could do that for you."
Yeah, that's awesome testimonial to that, how good you guys are at that, you know, technique, being able to authentically make people comfortable, make them authentically understand you do care about this, and that you know it's problematic, and that you understand their experience. All those things are really strong.
Oh, people just want to be seen, right?
Yeah, it's hard when you go across, like that's a very, I think it's a really interesting one with testing. Like, I remember the Tom Cruise, the leaked video of Tom Cruise screaming at everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? I mean, that's totally opposite. That's dominance and control and threat and punishment. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you've got to be, and people really took this whole, I mean, it's personal for a lot of people, right? And it really, I remember when the news first broke on it, I was actually shooting a Lifetime film in the middle of the Angeles National Forest. We were basically camping. We had no clue that there was a pandemic happening at all. And then, you know, and we get this like phone call from SAG-AFTRA, and they were like, "Everything's shut down. You have to stop shooting." And, you know, I mean, it was like in and out, because we were in the middle of the forest. We had no service. And we were like, "What?"
Right.
"What's going on?" And they said, "You have to put up signs everywhere." And we were like, "What?" And we came down into this like apocalypse. And, you know, and it was like, "You have to stay at home for 2 weeks." And I was like, "Yes." And then it was like watching everything unfold and how political it became so fast, rather than an actual public health concern.
And I talk about this, like you mentioned earlier, everybody stops for stop signs because you've been stopping at stop signs your entire life. You know red lights and green lights, and you know the safety public systems that have been put in place that have been rehearsed and practiced for literally decades for everybody. And so that stuff's not hard. Although yesterday I saw a guy here when I was coming back from the gym who just casually drove through eight red lights. I just watched him. Just like he would come up, clear the intersection, and then just go on through. Not even speeding. That is so weird to watch. But we're trained to all those. So we've got that in our minds. We've already acquiesced to that. And an apocalyptic virus suddenly appearing, nobody had any training with it. Like the idea that people would resist this, never even, like you saw like Fauci and a lot of the, you know, public health officials, just their eyes were like, "Are you kidding me? You people won't stay home? You won't wear a mask?" Like it was so weird that people wouldn't acquiesce. I'm like, you know, unless human beings are trained to something over long periods of time, they're going to resist change. Doesn't matter whether it's good for them or the whole world or not. They just will. That's the nature of the beast.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was weird. I mean, all of a sudden, everything that we thought was normal just flipped on its head. We had to adjust everything. We couldn't even buy toilet paper, right? Like, it was so weird. And, you know, and then it became like this polarized experience of us and them and this and that, and people, you know, and people who don't believe in vaccines and want to, you know, and don't believe in masks, and whatever is going to happen is going to happen. Oh, it's just this. Oh, it's just this.
Right.
Or, you know, and then it's like, oh my gosh, the people who are at risk are really at risk. And we have this juxtaposition of what we're seeing in the hospitals and what's really scaring, and like this other sense of what?
Right.
It's
no,
real.
And that's why, like, when I start the podcast and I say part of the purpose here is to bring more sophisticated tools into very complicated modern environments. And this, you know, we haven't had a pandemic since 1917. And so everybody's looking back like, well, what did we do then, or what happened then? And nobody really knows. So there was no precedent. There's no pre-training, you know, and this is what human beings do. Whenever there's an issue, they cluster around it. It doesn't matter what it is. It can be gay marriage. It can be, you know, getting people help after the pandemic financially. It doesn't matter what it is. You're going to get a cluster of reactivities. Over here are going to be the extreme, you know, anti and the extreme positive. That's how everything arranges itself around persuasion issues. And every one of those little dots has to be persuaded differently. And it becomes very complicated very quickly, which I think is interesting. Like when you go on to sets and you understand the psychology of people who are working all day long in these very specialized jobs that don't really exist outside of entertainment. And so you have an insight into that target audience about what would be the best strategy to bring.
Oh man. And everybody has a different feeling, and everybody has different politics, different worldviews. They were raised differently. They're from different places. And it's not a place for you to be political, right? It's like, you can't really be political. You have to go with whatever, you know, the rules are, the guidelines, the this and the that. But it's interesting. I was actually really interested in political theater when I was in college, and that was a lot of what my projects were. We're political theater. I was really always interested in politics and the way that the world worked. And I had this professor, and he had said to me, Steve Kent, he goes, you know, I was asking him all these questions about political theater, and he's like, well, everything's political, you know, everything is. What you do, what you, you know, what you choose to do every day is political, right? And you know, and some people are just really offended by others, and it's like, you know, and then we have this like huge gap that just continues to grow, and then we forget about the human parts of us that all require the same thing.
Yeah. Again, like the rhetoric of safety, what you work in, so let's very out of the pandemic and sort of testing. Safety is the baseline issue for all human beings. Like, until you're safe, you really you can't concentrate on anything else. So anytime danger comes up, it takes over the entire mind and, you know, activity of human beings. Like, there was a new article today about the kid in Virginia, the 6-year-old who brought a gun to school. And there's been no information about it really until like today. They leaked out some information about that he had been reported by 4 different people in the school for having that gun before the shooting ever happened. And the administration wouldn't take steps. They wouldn't let somebody search him. They didn't believe that he had a gun. And all this was reported like an hour before he actually shot his teacher. Now, if you take that story as a piece of rhetoric, it's an outrage story, right? You're immediately like, oh my God, these administrators are completely incompetent and they were responsible for this. And you don't know if that's true or not, but the story itself creates this emotional reaction. And you're like, how could you have not taken seriously a kid having a gun? Well, again, go back to the fact that that almost never happens. Like, how often has a 6-year-old ever brought a gun to school? it's a novel situation. And so how do you keep things safe like that in new situations? Because a real challenge for safety designers.
Yourself. Oh my gosh. Right. I mean, yeah. And then, you know, some more chunks to that story, right? Is that he's brought that gun to school multiple times and made threats before. And then also somehow, for some reason, the arrangement that was made was one of his parents had to be in the room with him at school, but it didn't happen. And where did he get that? You know, and it's like, and what steps do you take? How do you know? How do you know if something is going to be dangerous?
Right.
And I think that people are naturally, in a sense, good. They want to think the best of a situation, right? And, you know, oh, that wouldn't really happen. That, and then it does. And then it's like, what could I, you know, it's like safety is actually seen in hindsight.
Right.
You know, it's
except
very.
Except by people like you who have to see it in foresight.
Right. And that's the challenge. And, you know, and a lot of, and it's also it culturally not a huge part of what we're trained in and what we do, right? It's really not a part of us as an industry in the same way it is in like the UK, in a sense. Like they actually have in the UK, it's statutory. And so something like, you know, if something goes wrong on site, you might get charged with, involuntary man for, you know, criminal negligence in the UK. It's a little rare here. We've just seen that happen with Rust. And it's like, wow, how do you fix that? And, and it's like, oh, I think that's probably the hardest part of the job is really that foresight.
Yeah. And I think, again, that's where my field, I think, has stuff to offer, because rhetoric lays out an ecology that does, it's independent of what actually happens. It's like, okay, where are all the potential dangers here? What's a good outcome that we want? And how do we get people to accept that? And so it's very dissecting of the situation and very hierarchical about, we need to understand everything that could potentially be dangerous here. Maybe even rank order them to where it's like kids bringing guns to school, you know, in the first grade or second grade. Is that a high priority danger? Well, it's now a high profile danger. So we need at least a policy for what it is. And you don't want to overreact. So it needs structure and design. So that's the foresight part, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. You have to have that design. I mean, and also this is one of the reasons why people don't want to be teachers. It's now a dangerous place to be. And I don't even, I don't know that it really was before.
It's a weird, I was a professor for 20 years. And so I never felt physically in danger, although a couple of times, like I had some students that had mental problems and you could feel like it wasn't far away from them becoming a real issue. I had to have one student taken out of class, but it slowly became litigation dangerous, like for professors, where students would challenge their grades through a legal process. Like they would bring in lawyers. They would go through the entire administration complaining about a grade. And so now you had to defend yourself in a legal way. And some, they'd be like, well, did you follow the syllabus? I'm like, I did not write the syllabus as a legal contract. It's a syllabus. It's a rough estimation of how things are graded. If you want me to defend it as a legal contract, next time you're going to have a lawyer help me draw up my syllabus.
Yeah.
So you start to realize all these professions can become dangerous in a certain way, but like physical danger is a different thing, right? Like that's something that's so visceral and we see so much of it now that people tend to, you know, overreact to it or still underreact to it. And it just becomes sort of locked and complicated where we don't seem to make real changes.
So it's really interesting that you bring that up because in the study of crowd psychology, I just attended this really interesting workshop about crowd safety. And we had discussed in the group that crowds and audiences have changed because of COVID. And people are becoming more aggravated and excited and excitable and rude. Also, the industry has shifted on one level because a lot of people who were in the security field, when we all lost our jobs, they did too. They got jobs elsewhere doing something completely different that doesn't require them to, have the same stresses or, or whatever happened, they left the industry. Then you have these new people coming in, who are the security and this, that, and the other. And you're like, they're like, okay, they're so green, they don't know what to do. And then you have these people who are, easily riled up, and you just see this clash that you didn't see before COVID. And it was really a really fascinating discussion of whew, what am I getting myself into?
Right.
Why do I do this again?
We'll talk about that because you have, like you said, you're trying to expand into things like federal and state governments and different types of events than just sort of straight entertainment or production. And every time you move over to someplace else, you, like you said, you have a new audience. Like if you're doing a, an EDM festival, like you have to deal with drugs. Like it's a whole new thing. And so talk about that a little bit. Like, what do you see for your company? What are you interested in doing? Are you going to specialize in something so that you can kind of limit it and learn just that world? Or do you have to be a genericist where you can almost move from place to place?
So it's kind of interesting because we're a small company. I say we, it's like me and my senior manager. Like we're a company of two, and the work that we do is really gig based. So my company fluctuates in its amount of people all the time, right? Like that's sort of our nature. And we've done special events. And that's like our niche. We can do them in our sleep. And I don't think we'll stop doing that, right? Like
Like full range safety, like emergency, police, fire, everything, or
so we can do that. We can put together a private police force. actually that's Jonathan and I are working together. So it's like so that's part of that. We can put together field hospitals and that kind of and security and but but our bread and butter really is like the technical experts, right? Is actually if you want to go out and build something, we'll help you figure out if it's safe, if it's structurally safe. And we have audio experts who can produce studies on how sound will affect the neighborhoods. And it's like we've got meteorologists and the number one event closer is actually weather. That's how things get canceled and because it isn't safe to bring people out. And so it's a lot of environmental stuff that's sort of the key. I try to, I don't love the security part of it, but we have to, and we have to be involved in sort of counterterrorism. You know what? The government work is kind of easy, right? That's sort of why I like it. Everybody has events. And
Sure.
that's sort of what I'm interested in is kind of like, let's do something that isn't as stressful and crazy as entertainment always, and moving into new fields. And actually, so one of the things that I've been looking at, because we have awesome, I would say like probably our drawing factor is we do have some really radical technology. Like we can have wearables and apps that geolocate people, and if the in the event of an emergency evacuation, can evacuate a person to their nearest exit. We have like risk assessment and tracking software that's like machine learning and all these cool like gadgets and gizmos and so we want to bring it to, you know, we want to just like expand really at what, and I think for me it's mostly my curiosity.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot going on here to think about.
Yeah.
And the times I've spent quite a bit of time with Code 4 and Scott and Jonathan talking about, you know, how to communicate this out into the world. You know, how do you tell people everywhere from general public to government to private individuals who want to have events, you know, what safety should look like, and how do you sell the cost of it, and how do you sell how much of this you actually need, you know? And so it gets complicated very quickly, but especially this idea of when you look at a human event, there's so many areas that have to be thought of. Like you just said, like terrorism, like a major versus weather versus how do we herd people during an emergency? You know, all those things, you know, what has always impressed me about working with those guys is that they've experienced all these things. So they have experiential knowledge, they have technical knowledge, they have, you know, sort of theoretical knowledge about what they think is the best way to do it versus, you know, somebody else, a different expert, looks at it and says, no, I think it's this. And you start to realize like how arbitrary those choices are. You really want somebody great that you can rely on to make the right choices.
Oh yeah. I've been really thinking about what makes safety successful. It really is the talent. It's like getting the right people who have the experience. You know, there's nothing wrong with people who are starting out, but it's like you have to sort. It really does matter, and you have to be a part of a team, right? I think that it's really about the community that you build around the safety, is making sure that people are supported so that they can appropriately do their jobs in the best way that serves the project.
Yeah, it's an endless intellectual challenge, I think. And then the other thing is being able to execute, like having teams in place, making sure around that team is good, being able to actually get the right people, because it's hard yet to staff these things, you know, and everything raises the cost, right? Every time you increase safety on something, in some way or another, it increases the cost of the event.
Oh, absolutely. And and that's why people don't do it. You know, it's kind of almost like throwing money into a wishing well. You know, it's like, well,
yeah, it's sure prevention money, right? It doesn't make the event better. It just keeps it from going badly.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm sure it'll be fine. And then something happens and you haven't really actually invested anything. And, you know, and then you've got hit with litigation. There's not a way to measure it before it happens, because right, you could never imagine what could happen. And then it does. And you're like, didn't see that one coming.
A meteor. Wow. A meteor hit.
In the right. Middle of this event.
Crazy. So what are some of your general, when you think about people just designing their own safety, like coming into something, what do you look at when you come into these kind of situations? Because you've been around this a lot now and your brain churns on it a lot. What are some things that have sort of fallen out as general principles that you use?
I actually really examine the leadership. It does start from the top. And if I can get people on my side, right? Like, can I get you on my side? Can I get you thinking? Because I'm going to think about your experience also. And I need you to be thinking about mine, right? I want to make sure that you have a Fantastic show. I love entertainment as much as the next person. And this is the last place that we should be feeling unsafe or experience something negative in any shape or form. And so my goal is to make that experience seamless. I'm going to be thinking about you, and I really hope you'll be thinking about me too. I've actually banned people from my roster that I won't work with, because they will, as nice and as wonderful and professional as they are, sometimes it's like you're not really getting it, and it's not conducive for us to do our job. It really starts there. And if you're willing to listen, to also, I think there has to be a level of flexibility as well. You have to be able to adjust to changing environments, and you have to be able to adjust very quickly. Budget, yeah, you know, it's important to have a budget, but but if that's what's stopping you from something, you know, it's like, if it's like $500 and it's like, that's the thing that's going to stop you from, you know, it's like, come on, you know,
right.
a little bit can go a long way. And if you have the right people helping you, they can help you achieve that goal. I think it's important that the messaging and support also comes from the leadership, and not just like the leadership of the organization, but also working with department heads and going, you know, and coming to agreements with it is political, right? It's like, can you work with me to make sure that your team is going to be great? I would love to see everybody go home today. You know, I want to go home. You want to, let's all go home.
Right.
And, you know, you have to come up with agreements with people. That's really it. And it is a people job as much as it is, you know, you spend some time prepping and creating guidelines and this, that, and the other messaging and whatever. But it really is like, what are you doing on the ground to make sure that people feel that and want to participate? And it really is that groundwork.
Yeah, it's fascinating from sort of a 60,000 foot view up here about safety. Like when people look at, you know, I want to go to this music festival. And if they've been to a few of them, maybe they're not intimidated. They're like, it'll be fine. But if they're going new, like I've been doing cruise ships, stand up on cruise ships lately. And the first cruise was to Rio. So I had to fly to Uruguay, and then the boat went up the coast of Brazil and did 4 stops all the way up to Rio. And it was my first time to South America. I was in Brazil, and everybody was speaking Portuguese, and I was by myself. And so I'm wandering around through some of the destinations, sort of checking out the local culture. And just a few times it occurred to me, like, I don't know what's safe or dangerous around here at all. I can't really read the people. There's nobody for me to ask about what I should do if I get lost. So you sort of have to abandon all the things that you normally do to try to keep yourself into a comfortable space. Be like, okay, well, I'll only wander, you know, here. Like, I'm not going to go much farther. And then, like, there were some guys I was talking to that paid a guide to take them to the slums, which you can actually tour the slums in Rio, because they're so just intense and enormous, and like they're all colorful and they're up on mountains, and it's a bizarre world. But the guy that took them on the tour was from there. He had grown up in the slums and still lived there, and so everybody knew him. And so like they're like, yeah, there's some pretty shady gang characters talking to him while we were going around on this tour, and all these kind of things that you don't think about that you would normally expect on something like a commercialized tour to keep you safe. It's like, am I really safe with this person? You're kind of rolling the dice because your normal anchorings and the way that you normally evaluate the environment don't work. So it's fascinating.
Yeah, that is really interesting. In what environments, right? Where do you feel safe? And people who might be expected to take care of you might not.
Yeah, and you don't know how to vet those. Like, I couldn't find the boat that I was supposed to go to because it was hidden behind a massive boat. So the one I was on was like 750 customers, passengers, and it was hidden behind a 4,000 passenger boat. Like, you literally couldn't see the other boat. And I had no way to ask anybody until I found this one tour guide guy who spoke great English. I'm like, he was a young kid. And I'm like, hey, you speak English, help me find this boat. And he did. So, but you know, all the things you use to orient yourself and to keep yourself safe and to keep it from going too sideways, you don't have.
Oh yeah. And you know what? And that's what's so also dangerous about not have, about safety in the workplace is you expect a certain level of you don't know how to gauge it in the workplace. We're not trained in that sense.
Right.
And yeah, and also in our personal lives, it happens all the time.
Yeah,
Right.
and I think online dating is a really good example. Like the dominant story of don't be an axe murderer, I can't meet you. Like, I'm like, that's your first concern. Like, you think there's serial murderers hanging out here, you know? And I get it, but it's like, so you bring these expectations into that environment, and it kind of lowers the quality of the environment. It lowers the quality of the interaction. Are you being realistically safe? Are you being unrealistically safe? These, again, they change every time you move to a new situation.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And it's like, and then there are certain situations where you kind of lose your sense of, am I, you're kind of like gaslighting yourself, like, is my feeling about this right, or is it wrong, or am I just de-socialized?
Right. Well, and it goes back to bigger issues too. Again, in politics, a lot of what has happened in our politics in the last certain number of years is playing on the fears that people have because they don't feel safe because culture is changing so fast. Social media and technology is changing so fast. And suddenly you don't recognize the culture that you're in. And like globalism and interpenetration of cultures is changing so fast. You know, suddenly in Sweden, they've got a bunch of Muslims and they're like, what? I don't know what to do. I don't know if they're safe or dangerous. I was watching this little news clip where they're interviewing Swedes about, I don't like it. Like, yeah, I get it. You know, because you don't have the normal foundations that you use to evaluate the world. And so it becomes a huge political issue, safety versus non-safety.
Oh yeah. I mean, right. And it's like that's sort of that argument about the border, right? It's like, oh, this isn't safe. This isn't safe, and yet it's like the way that we've gone about it is just so wrong. Sure, there's certain things that are not safe, but kids in cages, come on,
Right, but the politics is a really fascinating rhetorical world because it doesn't really deal with reality. It doesn't really deal with truth. It deals with emotions. So if I can make you afraid of the border, which clearly the right likes that issue. Like they need, you know, white America, traditional white America to feel like there's just a flood of other colored people from other cultures coming into America all the time. And if they can establish that as you are not safe unless we are in power, you know, to fix this. So it's a strong political play, you know, and again, the rhetoric of politics is different than almost every other way human beings talk. But when you go into things like you're talking about where you get a disaster in your world, suddenly it's going to become political. Like it's going to become, you know, what can we, like Uvalde was a really interesting example of this tiny little school system nobody ever heard about. Suddenly, where are the villains? Where are the heroes? And that's typically what we do in these sort of where safety has been breached. We come in and we start wanting to assign story structures, like who's the villain here and who's the hero? Because that's much easier for people to understand in the media.
Well, that's how, so the history of theater actually is kind of fascinating. It really started in Egypt and the rituals. So ceremonies to certain gods, and they would act out. They, you know, it was really this, and that was how things were communicated. And then, you know, we're, you've got like the religious plays in England, and then, you know, you've got Shakespeare, and this, and it becomes this moral. It, there's this Roman called Horace, and so he said that the purpose of theater is either to teach or to please. And that's what we've got. And so no matter what, anything that comes out of your mouth is storytelling, is story crafting. And I really love that you brought that up. I took a spin doctoring class in college, which was probably one of my favorite things in
like
the world.
Like a PR course or a rhetoric course?
It was more rhetoric. It was just like a weird, you know, elective, right, for me.
Right.
First, yeah, spin doctoring. It was so much fun, you know, because it's like we would have these imaginary scenarios and we had to twist it up on its head and answer questions. And it was like it's like a game. And then, of course, you know, we watched Wag the Dog, right? Mm-hmm. You know, to avoid this whole scandal, they made up this imaginary scheme with Albania in it. And then all of a sudden, everybody's wearing, you know, F Albania shirt.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think one of the things I use in the rhetoric work that I do is the split between ethical and unethical rhetoric. So I typically teach unethical only persuasion or ethical only persuasion, because once you wander over into unethical uses of language, nobody can figure out anything. Like you can't use public discourse anymore because it's completely broken and corrupted. And so if you have one side that's completely making up stories and, you know, making these wild allegations and things like that, then public discourse breaks because nobody can rely on it anymore and becomes a real problem. And so like with spin doctoring, you know, and the PR people and things like that, we're like, well, we just need a good story here that's going to protect us. Yes, but that's not a true story. So it's an unethical technique. They don't care, but you're breaking public discourse for all humanity.
Ethical and unethical uses of language. Wow. I'm curious. I really want to like dive into that. I wish I could take that class.
Yeah, that's a super fun class. I think all that stuff, like when people really dig into it and like, oh, the world is all, you have to construct the world through language because that's the only way human beings can perceive things. You can't think about anything without language rushing in on top of it, which means you get to participate in the construction of your own reality. And that can go well and that can go badly. But, you know, it's something that you should learn how to partake in.
Oh, man. I mean, I'm in law school, right? So I have to read a lot of cases. And we just read this case, like Nixon v. the United States, in our constitutional law class. And the whole crux of the argument were hung on two words in the Constitution. There were two arguments and each one hung on one word. And language matters. Language matters. And, you know, and that was what the decision was made on. And the courts had to decide what the meaning of these words were so they could figure out what to do with this guy, right?
Yeah. Now, when you actually get attuned to what language does in our world, it's almost like taking microbiology, and suddenly you're like, oh, everything is kind of covered with other stuff and it's doing things all the time. And language, you sort of get the same way. Like every word you choose could potentially be the pivot word in this entire situation. And that's why rhetoricians are useful, because if you have a team of rhetoricians working on your messaging, they typically will go through all that stuff and they'll find super words and they'll amp certain words and they'll know how to stain the other side for its choices. So it gets to be a very much a chess battle.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, it's been super fun. I think you're in a really interesting area. It sounds like you're in law school. So is that to help your business? Or are you looking to vary out, or what are you looking to do?
So it's actually like my passion. When I started my business, I really didn't want it.
Sure.
You know, I thought I would get rid of it, but I really like working for myself, so I think I'm going to keep it. But that's what's been helping me get through law school.
Nice.
So I don't know what I'll do with it. I had some ideas at first, but but I was really inspired. I used to work for a lawyer when I was in college and in my small town, and it was my most favorite job, actually. Like, it was really great to be able to actually help people and like watch the weight just fall off their shoulders. And he was such a great guy, my boss. Small town lawyer, super chill. You know, his wife had an art studio next door. And so, I'd go
Sounds
over there.
good. I like this scenario.
It's great. Like, and his grandkids would come after school. They would walk the block and a half from school. And then there was like a little music recording studio. And my best friend worked at the coffee shop downstairs. And it was just like a really chill environment, not the typical legal environment ever at all.
Right.
But it was like, it really made me want to help people. And I like that if I could do it in that way, because when I lost my job in 2020, I was like, what do I do now? And I thought, well, maybe I can go back to school and get my paralegal, right? And I talked to him about it. He goes, don't do that. He's like paralegals. He's like, they do the same thing. They just get paid less.
Right.
He's like, go to school. He's like, do the whole thing,
No, it sounds like good advice.
So we'll see what happens, but I really enjoy it.
Well, cool. So tell people, like, if they are interested in bringing you your company in for an event, how do they find you? What do they do?
Yeah, so you could just look up safetyscs.com or just look up safety compliance services or look up my name somehow. I don't think it's even on the website. I don't My picture's not even on the website. You would not even know that I owned it. I think I might
True.
have it, but yeah, Safety SCS or Safety Compliance Services. There is another Safety Compliance Services somewhere else in the world. In the world, we do not do the same thing. My logo is so much cuter.
Well, that's important. The cutest logo wins,
Yeah.
I think, in some scenarios. I like that. Well,
Yeah.
super fun talking to you. Appreciate it. Everybody go check out the website. Clearly you've thought about this a lot. You got a lot of experience with it. You seem like you'd be awesome to work with. So, good luck to you in the world of safety.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Dan. Such a fun conversation with you.
Yeah, I just really enjoy the when you get into somebody's world and then you sort of throw in some of these concepts about designing the messaging to get you where you want to go. It's always a good conversation. So,
Oh man, really thought-provoking too.
well, enjoyed it. You guys, this has been Teresa Beardsley. Go check out her website and keep getting out there and persuading people, because clearly we all need it.
Yeah.